I believe what that is, knowing what your value is in the marketplace, knowing what your transferable value is, knowing how that you can do more than what you did in the past. So many people have gifts, and I don't say everybody has gifts. Everyone has something that has a value in the marketplace, but sometimes we don't believe it. Sometimes we don't see it. So sometimes I think the real questions are asking questions that help you see, as a job seeker, somebody who might be in a search down the road, understand transferable value. If you understand your transferable value and you can see that with confidence, then that changes a whole lot of things. And that's another point that I'll come back to here shortly, but it changes a whole lot of things. Transferable value has more to do than your past experience, your past subject matter experience. I'm an expert on ozone. I'm an expert on refining processes and pumps and valves and how you make semiconductors and how you make goldfish. I'm an expert in so many different things. But what my value might be, or what the value you might be, is being an analytical thinker, strategic thinker, a collaborator, somebody who learns, somebody who is just curious. So finding out those other value points can be huge. Another point of value is understanding questions about perspective and, well, what's going on in the marketplace. If you've been in one job or one industry most of your career, that would tend to mean that, not absolutely, but you don't really understand the full plate of what's growing and what are the new types of jobs and what are the new types of roles that exist in the marketplace. So again, those perspective questions are usually like the starting point. One of the things I think that I'm very proud about Joseph People across all of our chapters is the guidance that we have in our journey document about job search process. And one of the things that we really beat the band about is being prepared to network. When you know that most jobs do come from networking or somebody leading you towards a business, then a second round of questions is more about, well, how do you network? How do you make those connections? How do you find people? So asking questions about where's the job, you know, what would you do if you were me, what would you do? Kind of mushy questions, not going to lead to very tangible, significant growth. But if you ask questions about who are the people that would that tend to know people, who are the people that you know that tend to have perspective or understand job search, well, now you can lead people to other people who are connected or people who have got guidance or wisdom, and that always bears a lot more fruit. There are experts in Joseph People who are gurus on resumes, people who are gurus on networking and connectivity, people who are gurus on doing the fundamental research to find out, well, what are the businesses that are right here in the backyard? So if we ask questions that are more specific to the job search process, you're likely going to get the precise help that you need. Asking more specific questions is going to give you more valuable, more specific results. Asking general questions can come across as though that we're missing some of the fundamentals. So I think the first questions have more to do with direction and focus. What industry? What roles? What income level? Or what salary? Or what type of geography? Those are questions that are like primary. Second questions are more about transferable value. Looking at accomplishment statements and how do I present value? Or can you help me? Like, this is what I did, but what's the value? How do I articulate value out of that? That would be a second tier of questions. Third tier then would be about resume and written and verbal tools. How do I introduce myself? How do I answer some of those tricky questions that people come up would answer? That's another layer of questions. The big set of questions then comes around networking and connectivity. I've spoken to this chapter and not all the chapters, but many of the chapters about networking conversations. So when you're networking, there are three primary questions that are going to produce significant results. If you are prepared and you have a list of target organizations, and there's a central theme about them, not like Rorschach and random, but there's a specific like theme or industry or roles that you're exploring. And then you ask questions like that go like this, and here are the primary three. You ask the question, who do you know that works in these companies? Second question, who do you know who might know people who work in these companies? I'll give Ron a fair chance to write it down.
And just so you know, this will be posted to the website.
Okay. Third question. If you were me, and you were building and growing your professional network in this industry, who would you talk to? And if you answer those three questions, you're going to get referrals. People are going to know somebody. And then when they know somebody, you have to ask this question. And you can do some theme and variation with it, but I like to ask the question, gee, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you know Steve Bailey?
Can you say the third one again?
The third question is, if you were me, and you were growing your professional network with the intention of exploring opportunities in this industry, or these types of organizations, and sometimes it's a theme, it might be an environmental theme, it might be a food theme, hospitality, whatever, but if you were me, and you were intentionally growing your connectivity, your network in this area, who would you talk to? Who are your go-to people? Who are your connectors? Who are the centers of influence that you're familiar with? And then you ask this other question. Whenever there's a referral or identified contact, ask the question on a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you know that person? Now, if somebody says, well, I linked in with John 10 years ago, but I never spoke to him, I never even met the guy, but we're linked in. That's not a strong basis to ask somebody, hey, would you introduce me? But people do that all the time, and LinkedIn is not that strong. It's a web of connectivity, but it's not that strong in terms of, we don't have information about the strength of relationships. So you've got to ask that question. But on a scale of 1 to 10, if it's a 5 or better, now you can ask the question, say, John, since your relationship with Steve Bailey's about a 7, would you do me a favor? Would you let Steve know that I'm going to give him a call? And you would say, look.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And I could say, John, is there any chance you can get that done by Friday? Because I'd like to call Steve by Monday morning.
I'll send him an email and copy you.
Great. Here's some math. In networking, if you ask those three questions, you're probably going to get, on the average, and I'm saying on the average, 3 to 5 referrals. For every person you connect to, you're going to, on the average, generate 3 to 5 referrals. They may be 1s on a scale of 1 to 10, they may be 10s on a scale of 1 to 10, but you're going to get 3 to 5 referrals. If it's a 1, you've got to work a little bit harder to get somebody to answer the phone when you call. No doubt about it, that's all. It's not exactly the same as a pure random out of the blue call, but it's kind of like that. But if somebody asks you, well, how did you get my name? I spoke with John, I was at a meeting, and John recalls you from something, and he suggested I reach out to you. Oh, yeah, I remember John. Oh, yeah. He said, and all of a sudden, it's like a friend of a friend is a friend of yours. In social science, it's called a weak tie. Boy, in a job search, you can take a lot of comfort that weak ties tend to be very helpful, and they're the types of things that won't get you connected ultimately to key decision makers. That's how you generate opportunity. The truth is, in larger, more sophisticated companies in this day and age, if you really have your heart set on working at a Comcast, you're going to have to go through that portal called the job form application or an online application. Many companies have them. Certainly the companies with, I'd say, about 200 employees or more, they're going to have that portal. But it sure does make a difference if you can network your way to people that you know towards key decision makers. There's a science across the world. It's that theme of it's a small world. Everybody knows somebody. Everybody's connected. Between me and anyone that lives in the Amazon, it's just 6 degrees of separation, no more. And so the same thing is true for you. If you want to connect to Kevin Bacon, 6 degrees of separation. If you want to talk to Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'm sure by just talking to people, you're going to get there. If you wanted to introduce yourself to Taylor Swift, I can get you there in 3 people. Do you want to talk to Taylor Swift? Thank you. My dad baptized her, by the way. The thing is, everybody knows somebody. Everybody knows somebody. So the thing is, and this is what stops people. Before they ask for help, we're rationalizing. Well, why would Steve know somebody? Why would Ron know somebody? We're almost like talking ourselves out of asking for help. But you know people. Everyone knows somebody. So think of, just reach out to talk to friends, because you never know who your friend knows. There's no way that LinkedIn is the end-all be-all of connectivity. That gives you some clues, but it's not the end-all be-all. So asking for help, particularly in those the networking conversations, that's where really we bring a lot of clarity to connectivity. Some of you might be in the phase of interviewing. And so let's rephrase some of the questions in interviewing. A lot of times when we're in interviewing, we're asking questions that are probably appropriate, like what does this job pay? What's the pay racket? What are the hours? Where would I work? What would I, you know, there are a lot of logical and reasonable questions that you would ask. But I would suggest that in an interview, you could ask a different set of questions. What if you ask questions that set up your value? You all familiar with the game of volleyball? In volleyball, somebody sets it and somebody spikes it. You can do both. See, in the game of volleyball, there's no double taps. If you set, you can't spike. But in interviewing, you can. Supposing I would say that one of my greatest strengths are collaboration. I could ask a question in an interview. Tell me about, how does your team work together? Do you find it valuable to have people that can work it across different parts of the organization, different levels? Yes, indeed, we do. That's a very well trait. They can say, well, you know, one of my strengths is as a collaborator. And for example, and then I could pivot to one of my collaboration-based accomplishments, statements. Asking better questions sets up better opportunity to actually receive the help that you want. Pretty cool. So there are a lot of different ways that we can tighten up the questions that we ask. Ultimately, though, it's by paying attention to the questions that we ask. Ultimately, it's having the courage to ask questions without fear of, you know, am I going to look silly? Am I going to, you know, is this going to embarrass me? Just ask questions. Because I find that the most important part of the questions you ask is being thoughtful, being intentional about the questions, like, where does this series of questions lead to? But if you have courage and there's a kindness and the intention of your job search is actually contributing that add to a business, there really is no foul. There's no referee throwing yellow flags on the field. It's like the questions you ask really are empowering. And if you're asking powerful questions and there's a loving intention inside of it, what actually happens is you inspire the people that you're talking to. They'll feel your courage. They'll feel that you have a sense of purpose and passion for what you're doing and what you're exploring. And they're going to want to help. In fact, you might inspire them. One of the sad realities of the American workforce is that most people aren't happy at work. When Gallup does their engagement studies, year after year, the statistics are pretty poor. And so many different authors that write leadership books and everything else, they go back to their own studies or other stories that really come back to about the same percentage of numbers. But here you are, and you're asking questions that are courageous, that are powerful, and there's this intent to make a difference and to play your strengths in the marketplace. And other people are going to take notice, and they're going to want to help you. Pretty cool. Let me flip the coin, and this is a part of the discussion that I think is a little bit invisible to most people in a job search, and that is the receiving part. It actually takes some preparation to receive. In other words, you can ask all the great questions, the contextual questions, the questions about guidance and connectivity, and really the questions that set up your value in an interview, but if you're not prepared to receive, all the guidance in the world will ricochet. So let me just ask you, how would you know that you're ready to receive? What would it look like? What comes to mind?
I'm not quite sure what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's an obtuse question. I get that.
Let me ask, how do you respond to a typical or question that they ask of you?
Yeah. So, supposing I'm in a job search, and man, I'm worrying like crazy. I'm anxious. I got bills to pay. I got this worry. When am I going to get a job? I'm nervous. And I'm now speaking to somebody who's given me the best guidance in the world. What's going to happen if I'm anxious, if I'm worried, if I can
show an interview?
Yeah, a lot of the guidance will ricochet.
Yeah, you're not going to process it.
Because what I'm listening for is out of my neediness. And so people's guidance and their wisdom and the value that they're sharing with me is going right around me because they're not giving me out of my neediness and my anxiousness. I'm missing the guidance that's actually there. The other thing that happens sometimes is I'm worried about what somebody else thinks about my questions. I'm worried about, am I going to be good enough? Do I deserve this? I'm multitasking as I'm listening. So that, I mean, even though I might be well-intentioned, a lot of guidance goes around us. We miss the very guidance that people are sharing with us all the time. So one of the bits of wisdom that I would share is to practice quieting your mind, to practice listening to understand what somebody's saying, to then ask questions that bring clarity to what somebody's offering. If I don't understand, rather than just letting it and saying, oh, I got it, stopping and asking for clarity, asking for some follow-up questions. Now the guidance that's coming to you, you're going to actually absorb it. And if you ask follow-up questions on somebody's guidance or their referrals or so forth, they actually appreciate the fact that you're staying with them in the conversation. But being ready to receive, I think that's as important as the questions that you ask. If we're nervous, if we're still upset about something that happened in the past, if we're so nervous over here, what happens is it reshapes how we think. And I would say this, sometimes we've got to do that homework to understand what a transferable value is so we actually see ourselves as valuable. If we see ourselves as valuable, if we actually trust that we have worth and value and that we are enough, we don't have to go for an MBA. We don't have to do this. We don't have to shore up our weaknesses. We can just say, I am enough. And we're actually positioning ourselves to listen with more tuned antenna. A very subtle part about receiving guidance is this. There is so much guidance that doesn't come from somebody physically in front of us, but it's more the intuitive guidance. More than intuitive guidance. So when we pray for guidance, we pray for help, sometimes the answers are coming right to us through our intuition. But if we don't see ourselves as worthy or good enough, then I'm going to be latching on to everybody else's guidance, and I won't trust my own intuition. Make sense? Not easy to hear, not easy to kind of grasp that, but that's the guidance that's available to us nonstop. But if we're thinking that it's out here, it's always out here, it's always out here, then we never take time to actually process all the conversations from wonderful people that show up in our lives, and we never really process that other internal guidance that's coming at us 24/7. That intuitive guidance, boy, that can be powerful. That can be a really powerful stuff.
One question. Is it okay to ask if you're in an interview and they ask you or they're talking about something and you don't want to sit there and nod your head per se? Is it okay to ask, can you clarify, can you elaborate or something? I'm not sure I understand your point. Is that a negativity on your part?
Anthony,
the person?
You interview people all the time. What would you say?
I'd say it depends on how great. If it's rather abrupt, and if I'm asking you a question, I actually do this a lot. Sometimes I tend to explain myself a little too long and then ask the question. If it's an abrupt kind of, can you clarify? I didn't get that. It's more of, okay, I heard you say this, and I have an idea, but could you just clarify this point and what kind of you're looking for, and actually going to the point of kind of setting in and receiving the volleyball thing, you can almost set up what what they are wanting to hear, or what, not what wanting to hear, but what they are looking for in your response. So I think you're going along this path, but can you clarify this little point, because I have some examples of this. So it's all about how you phrase it and how you respond.
Yeah, I wouldn't interrupt. I would let the opposite person interviewing me ask him, and then once he or she has stopped, then I said, is it my understanding that, or I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at or something like that, but only after they, you know, complete their thought or question, then to say, hey, I'm not sure exactly what you're looking for, or understand your point. Could you please reiterate or whatever rephrase? Is it okay to?
Oh, absolutely.
I think I've done that in actual.
What they're looking for is active listening. So not just, because some interviewers will think, well, he wasn't listening. It's more so, I heard your question, here's a point that in your question, so you're reiterating kind of their question, so they know you're paying attention and listening, and then you're coming back with, can you just clarify this little point so I can just provide kind of a concise response? Something like that.
I heard what you said, and that fascinates me, or I want to make sure I understand it with a little bit more clarity. Would you mind elaborating? Would you mind expounding? Would you mind... Or I might say, here's what I heard you say. Did I capture that accurately? So you could paraphrase, you could rephrase it. I think the key is, like, you're doing it not with an intention to understand what was said. And that feels a little differently on both sides of the equation. But if you're judging what's said, like if you disagree with what they said, that's gonna, then you project that. And the other person, now that they could be, oh, this is difficult. That would have it not go well. A lot of times people, the way that they listen is with a sense of judging or prejudging. And so the person that they're speaking to, they'll feel that. They can actually feel what it feels like to be in a conversation with you. So good questions feel great. Challenging and disbelieving and judging questions don't feel so good. So you're in an interview, and there's back and forth, and you're asking questions, so you're asking for clarity, and you might actually be asking for an opportunity or for what are the next steps. And you're receiving information, and as you're receiving information, what does it look like? What is your body language? What is your posture? What kind of dynamics are going on as you're receiving guidance or information during an interview?
You're referring to how we should be posturing ourselves.
What it looks like. How would you describe what you look like in an interview? Like this?
I usually sit upright and sort of lean
a little.
No, never like that. No, not as
like
a fact. No. I have my notebook. You know, where I can take notes if I want. I have it open during the whole time. Because I also have my sort of cheat sheets when I ask questions at the end.
Okay.
But I'm leaning as like I'm enthused and listening to you, but I'm not slouching or anything. I'm sitting up straight and sort of leaning with a little, not like hunched over, but just leaning a little forward to...
What are your hands doing?
I usually have sometimes to keep my hand... I usually got my hands sometimes... like this or by my side or something.
A lot of people are self-conscious and they don't want the other person to see them fidgety, so they're either clench or they hide their hands underneath the table.
I don't do that. I know what I do. I might something like this, or my hands are to my side because I'm usually at times holding my notebook and looking down at some notes so that I know.
Cool. This I'm going to share some guidance that you may not have heard before and might seem counterintuitive. Ron, I see you taking notes tonight. That's appropriate. I would say that's highly appropriate in an interview. And Steve, you're talking about it with your cue sheet. That's okay. So take in a portfolio. Put your cue sheet over here. Have a notebook. And take notes of the things that are important. don't take notes to capture every word and wait a minute, I'm not finished writing. I mean, that'll certainly interrupt the flow. But the important notes, the other person will feel like, well, he's taking notes. This is, you know, there's some serious exchange going here. What typically doesn't work is a good schoolboy or the good schoolgirl. That has to sit politely and properly, and they're stiff. What does work, I find, is like a live presence, but a vulnerability to it. Almost like you're open to the conversation, and here to interview them and to really make sure this is a fair exchange of information back and forth. But a lot of times people go into an interview and they're very guarded. The guard might be this. The guard might be this. Or, you know, there's no notes. There's, you know, they're trying to impress people that they have a good memory or good recall. It's not about impressing people. It's about a fair exchange of value and information in an interview. I find that if people are up all the time, then that becomes a little bit tiring in terms of body language. So if there's, like, to clarify or to offer something, then sometimes up. And go back is more like a reflection. If there's a question you have to think about, it's okay to go back and reflect upon it. But the posture that's going to serve you well most of the time is neutral. But then allow yourself to be dynamic. Allow some hand gestures and allow more of an open body language. Open body language typically reflects an open mind. It's amazing how the subconscious really controls the body language. But you want what's important is the congruency. So you might have to actually practice that. And if you practice presenting, if you practice interviewing, then it becomes natural. That confidence follows the practice. It doesn't work just to say, oh, I have to be confident. Well, if you practice your interviewing, then typically that's there.
I think it's probably important to look interested.
I would say not just look, but be interested. Like in every interview, learn, grow, share.
You know, actually, Ron put some point that I was going to bring up, but it's showing that you're listening. How are you doing that? It's not only your body posture, it's not only what you're doing with your hands, your notebook, but it's also, as they're talking, giving you information, responding to your question. It's not just, some people do the school boy, school girl, and then it's not that. It's like what you said, interested.
Interact.
Yeah, exactly. It's interaction. Not too much, not too little, but showing that interest. And catching yourself facial expression wise. So that's what we're talking about.
Questions? Tom, what's your question? What would you do differently in terms of asking and receiving? Do you see any area that you would shift, modulate, or do you see anything that, oh my gosh, I'm going to do more of that because you're already doing it.
Preparing to ask for contacts and having that focused area that you're looking for, I think, is something that I have not done in the past.
Can make a world of difference.
And yeah. Then, because now, when you ask for live people to reach out to, the person has an idea of what it is that you're going to be approaching them about. And then they can better identify who makes sense to put you in touch with. And then the last question, how well do you know them, which is effectively saying, can I get a positive connection to this person through you? I think is very important.
Ron, does this give you some new insights?
Yeah, it's refreshing just to think about it. One thing that, you know, about asking, I think people are concerned about what the interviewer is going to ask them, the questions that they're going to ask them. So it's probably good to look through that kind of questions, and there's lists of them, right? So what's your opinion about that kind of subject?
I definitely have an opinion here.
The new school or what everybody is, has gravitated towards pretty much the behavioral interview. So they're, the point of behavioral interviewing from the interviewer side is past behavior predicts future behavior. So what they're looking for is examples and things like that. So just like I told a dozen people that are looking for this kind of advice is, when you go into an interview, it's not necessarily, you're going to get the general questions, you know, what are your top three strengths, what are your weaknesses, those kind of things. Have those ready, but in the past or in this type of situation, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with that? Have those examples, have those situations in your mind. So you're ready to spit out a clear, concise response with an example. So you're responding, you're giving those examples, you're showing the, I guess, how to be concise in your response. But that's what they're looking for. Not generalities, not, oh, I think I'd do this, I think it would do this. It's how have you done that? And how would that apply to the workplace?
If you were going to say six possible questions, I know one is going to be, tell me about a difficult situation you had with a coworker. Tell me about a time when you excelled in a project. So are there like six that are most advantageous to prepare for? How many of them do you think there are? And are there like six that if you prepare for those six, you're likely to get two or three of them as the questions you're going to get?
I think it's important to look at the description, whatever job description they're putting out, and hitting the spots. There will be this position does this, and how have you done that in the past? So have those ready as examples, and then those type of situations.
Yeah, those are the skills, but I'm saying, you know, like, how did you deal with a difficult coworker? I know that's what I'm going to get, because I'm getting it in a behavioral interview.
Mm-hmm.
Where's a project that you succeeded, and what techniques did you employ to be successful is one I've gotten. So what I'm looking for is, are there, you know, as I said, six, that if you prep for those six kinds of questions, you're likely to get two or three of them in addition to ones that you're not prepared for.
Those two are good. The other one is, when have you been given a task, faced an obstacle, and how did you overcome that obstacle? Or was there ever a situation in which you were given a task and you didn't succeed? I mean, that's what they're looking for, how you overcame adversity in some way, shape, or form, how you overcame a challenge, how you stressed yourself. So I would say those, the two you had said, those two are pretty big. You got to prepare for what is your greatest weakness or what is your biggest opportunity. You have to prepare for that to be able to spin it positively. So those are the major ones I would say.
Thank you.
Tom, if you Google tricky interview questions or difficult interview questions, you're going to find 5,000 questions.
Oh, I know, and that's why I'm saying, you know, from an HR perspective, they're not going to ask all 5,000.
No, they're not.
Are there a group of 10 that they typically draw from that maybe you could be prepared for three or four of them?
Right.
And then have to win the other two?
Well, hold on. If you Google situational behavior questions or behavioral-based questions, again, you're going to find hundreds of questions. There's another field of study. It's referred to as appreciative inquiry. And appreciative inquiry is like asking a question that sets up an insight about innovation or how people handle or would relate to things that are ambiguous or complex or vague, or, you know, how do you deal with it? Do you have to have things nice and neat, or can you deal with that kind of chaos? So I don't know that there's anything that you can't memorize 5,000 questions. You can't memorize all the, but you can go back and look at, in this role and in this industry, what are the likely environments or circumstances? And in a lot of businesses, whether it's manufacturing or whether it's healthcare or nursing or whatever it is, it's like you have human dynamics. So what are those human dynamic and what are those key relationships? A couple relationships that I think you could focus on are relationship to trust, relationship to change or control or loss of control, a relationship to authority. So you can look at a series of relationships, but it's more about the experiences that you can reasonably anticipate in the course of a career. And then I think it's not about having the clever response. It's about an authentic response. And weaknesses. I've gone to another group, they're called MyCareerTransitions.com, and I've heard somebody say, here's how you respond to that, what's your greatest weaknesses? Well, it's because I like to work, or, you know, because I'm very passionate. And it's almost like, you know, gang me with a spoon is so syrupy or so kind of, I don't want to say phony, but yeah, phony. If somebody were to ask me my weaknesses, I would say, you know, it's quality assurance, it's the detail. I can do it. And I've edited a lot of people's work. But that just drains the bejeebers out of me. So my preference is this, and that's why I'm exploring some more strategic. So it's like if you know what your strengths are, that also gives some clue as to what are the weaknesses. So you can talk about that in a very authentic and open way. And oftentimes, what happens is you've earned some, because of your authenticity, you've garnered more respect. You've garnered, and it doesn't necessarily exclude you unless you're applying for QA, a QA role. You just know that's not your forte.
One thing, have you ever gone to Glassdoor at all?
Occasionally.
So Glassdoor was built on reviews of the company. Well, now they actually have a tab or a section interview questions. So for, and now these, you'll find these in large organizations like a Comcast or Comcast.
You mean interview questions that people are posting that they were asked?
That they were asked.
Okay.
Right. So that can be a good resource for larger organizations. It's not going to be as effective for smaller organizations, but mid-level to large organizations, it can be very helpful.
Yeah, and going back to what's your weakness, mine is that I'm too honest. I'm honest to a fault. I'm honest to the point where I say things that probably aren't in my best interest, but it's just how I operate. And now I'm talking too much and probably being too honest even then in the interview by saying it. But that's, I don't know how that's received, but that's the one when I say, when they ask for a weakness, that's the one I give. It's that I'm just too honest. I reveal things that probably aren't in my best interest.
Yeah, another thing people look for on, and you can kind of play this up in an interview, I went on the Mid-Atlantic Employers website the other day. It's a big industry association for HR people. They sell software that helps evaluate fits because they want to see how you'll fit into their company, their culture, what their values are. And that's a big thing. So if you are prepared to answer questions about that or ask, a good thing is to ask them questions about their culture or whatever.
Any other takeaways from that? Any other lingering questions? Everything lifted up that we're afraid to ask. Okay. Well, cool. I'll hang around a little bit to answer any specific questions. It's